You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Quad Cities NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and you know, every once in a while, a book comes along during a political campaign that's really well-timed. It discusses perhaps a candidate or an issue or a voting group, or perhaps a term that's used a lot that maybe people remember a little bit from history or civics class and needs a little further explanation. And my guest today has written a really well-timed book about populists and populism. The book is called Forgotten Populists: When Farmers Turn Left to Save Democracy. And the author is Steve Babson, who I'm very pleased to have with me today. He's a retired instructor at the Labor Studies Center at Wayne State University, and he lives in Detroit. Steve, thanks for coming on today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm looking forward to this because I think a lot of my listeners, too, I see this term used a lot. My sense of what populism is and isn't, I kind of disagree with sometimes what it's used, but let's start at the basics here. What is the proper definition of populist with a small p?
Well, I try to use the large p because as an historian, I'm focused on what the populists were actually on the ground in American history, as opposed to the way it's now used as sort of a sociological or almost psychological term that's applied, I think, indiscriminately and without much use for us in terms of understanding the current political terrain. But the populists that I'm focused on and that I'm thinking about are the populists in the 1890s who actually changed the political terrain of this country rather dramatically. They were a bunch of coal miners and farmers and a wide range of reformers who saw the problem of the growth of these enormous corporations after the Civil War in the decades after 1865. And they were scandalized by the fact that both the Democrats and the Republicans of that era, the 1880s, 1890s, were devoted to actually augmenting the power of those corporations and were complicitous with their fraud and their profiteering and price gouging. And so reformers in both parties found it difficult to actually make their way into changing the course of where their parties were at. And so, because at that time there was no primary system. So alternative voices within both the Democrats and the Republicans arguing for a turn towards a more populist, actually as it ended up being defined, attention to the needs of the people, they had to form a third party. There was no alternative at that point. And they called it the People's Party. And as a sort of shorthand nickname, they were termed the populists. And what they were angry about was, as I said, how Democrats and Republicans were favoring that ruling class of corporate robber barons, people like Andrew Carnegie, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Jay Gould, the robber barons of that era. And they wanted to augment public power. They saw an expanded government capacity to regulate and restrain and control the profiteering of these massive corporations as a positive thing. They wanted to expand democratic access to that government, because at that time women couldn't vote, and obviously voting rights for African Americans in the South were severely constrained. So what the populists wanted to do was expand voting rights, include women in the vote, protect the access to the ballot of Black farmers in the South as an alliance of Black and white farmers in the South and in the plains of small-scale farmers, corn and wheat growers, in an alliance that would then be able to amplify the power of the government in a positive way to restrain the profiteering of these major corporations. And actually what happened is that it ended up changing the internal dynamics of both political parties. Both the Republicans and the Democrats were forced by the success of the populists. And this is important. They actually had some substantial success as I try to outline in Forgotten Populists, they elected over 50 members of Congress. They elected six senators. They elected thousands of local officials who were committed to this idea that we needed to regulate the railroads. And if the railroads wouldn't comply and accept that regulation on behalf of public goals, then maybe the government should take over those railroads and run them as a public service. This is the time, by the way, when also farmers are paying extraordinarily high interest on debt. And farmers are often indebted. They have to wait till the harvest before they can pay off the loans they took out during the course of the year to buy supplies and equipment. And in the South in particular, they were dependent on basically the plantation owner who was renting the land to them, either as tenant farmers or as sharecroppers. And they had to go to the company store on the plantation or in the nearby town, and they're paying interest rates of 50 to 60 to 100% to buy the necessary equipment and supplies. And so what the populace said, well, there should be an alternative here. Farmers should be able to go to the post office and get a loan through a postal savings bank at 2% interest. And when their harvest is due, they can bring it to a public warehouse rather than having to sell it in a panic so they can get the cash to pay off their loans. They can put it in a public warehouse and get a loan from the federal government at 2% interest. Now, this is a sort of collective approach on behalf of augmenting the access to the market of small-scale farmers. So it's an interesting kind of mixed economy that they're talking about here, with public enterprise to support private initiative. Kind of an interesting approach, kind of a middle ground in terms of our history. And finally, the Democrats pick up on this, and they start to incorporate aspects of the populist program. And that's what eventually, over time, produces, I would argue, and many others as well, by the 1930s, that's what the New Deal is about, is a transformed Democratic Party that acts on behalf of the broader interests of workers and farmers who need protection against the profiteering of huge corporate employers and controllers of the commercial economy.
This period of history that you're looking at, to me, when I grew up anyway, studying, it's really kind of passed over a lot, I think, anyway, in historical terms, this post-Civil War era leading up to the New Deal and the Great Depression. This is marked by the trends you're just talking about here, but also huge voter turnout that is just unheard of now in terms of how people going out and casting votes. Now, we didn't have women didn't have the right to vote yet. Blacks didn't have the right to vote. But still, among the voting eligible voters, this was attracting 80 and 90%. So these issues you're talking about were reacted by the public very viscerally, I would say.
Yes, absolutely. And it's an important part of our history because, as I say, it transformed both parties. The reform groups within both parties are augmented by the obvious demonstration the populace were tapping into a widely felt need. And in the Republican Party, they call themselves Progressive Republicans, which might sound like an oxymoron today, but was a major part of the Republican Party for many years until finally in the 1930s, many of them migrated over to the New Deal Democrats. And in the Democratic Party, in 1896, William Jennings Bryan, a Democrat, adopts part of the populist program, expanding the money supply by monetizing silver. He doesn't pick up on the populist program of also actually issuing greenbacks, that is paper currency, no longer backed by gold, but by the good faith and power of the government, which is the kind of money we became accustomed to eventually. The populists, many of what they proposed, they came to pass. Things came to pass. Votes for women. Election of senators, by the way, I forgot to mention that. Senators were appointed in the 1890s by bought and sold legislators. Legislatures and state legislatures. And so what the populace wanted was direct votes for senators. They wanted votes for women. They wanted secret ballots so that you weren't walking up to the local political power system and having to publicly hand your ballot to someone who would note how you had voted. And in the South, that's how they actually terrorized blacks and whites, but particularly blacks, into voting for the Democrats, who were obviously white supremacists and were suppressing black interests and black farmers. And so the populists are actually pushing to protect the ballot in the South, pushing to protect the ballot on the plains. And what they wanted, therefore, was something that was seen as very dangerous by the power interests, particularly in the South. And a lot of Jim Crow, what we understand is Jim Crow, the suppression of voting rights, the poll taxes and the literacy tests and the outright terrorism that dramatically reduced the voter turnout you're talking about in the South. That is a response to populism. They saw this black-white multiracial alliance as sufficiently dangerous to provoke yet another round of suppression of black voting rights in the South.
You say in the book that 1892, that election you just described, which was McKinley and William Jennings Bryan, was that the high watermark of the populist movement? How did they do in that election at the presidential level?
Well, that was 1896 when Bryan ran against McKinley.
Yeah.
And Bryan actually got about 47-48% of the vote. And this was in a very polarized atmosphere in which the powers that be, in this case, the Republican Party, and the corporate interests that massively financed the campaign of McKinley to suppress the populist movement, they actually characterized what the populists were about as almost a psychopathological movement of resentment and anger and sort of unwarranted, irrational attacks on corporate efficiency. Now, the corporate efficiency was a myth in its own right. The bank, if you look at the railroad system of that era, it's characterized by massive bankruptcy and huge amounts of fraud that not only gouged farmers and others hoping to ship their crops and their goods, but also defrauded investors on a massive scale with watered stock, with CEOs, Jay Gould, for example, the CEO of several railroads, would actually short his own company's stock so that he could secretly profit at the expense of investors. So this is an era of widespread corporate fraud, which was regarded as the privilege of those who were in positions of power.
I guess my question is focused more on where did they do the best at in this election?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, they did the best in Kansas, for example, South Dakota, Nebraska, North Carolina, Western states as well, particularly mining districts where coal miners and silver miners will ally themselves with the populace, railroad towns as well. Less successful in places like Iowa and Illinois and, for example, Wisconsin. And in some cases there, for Wisconsin in particular, progressive Republicans pick up on many of these issues and they run on platforms that are very similar to what the populace were calling for. They're now back within the two-party system because in Wisconsin, the progressive Republicans take control of that party. And in Iowa, for example, populism is much less successful. And part of what's going on there is that the Republican Party in Iowa had to respond to an earlier wave of protest voting by the Greenback Democratic Coalition of the 1880s. In 1886, the Greenbackers were the ones calling for an expansion of the money supply by the government printing greenbacks, paper bills, like as we've become accustomed to. But at that time, that was rare. The money supply was limited to the available reserves of gold. And so you couldn't print more paper money than the limited amount of that precious metal that was held by government treasuries and by banks. And so the money supply was restricted. That meant it was more expensive to borrow money. And on that basis, a lot of farmers were looking for an expansion of the money supply. Now, in Iowa, the Republicans responded to the interests of farmers in a way that didn't happen in Nebraska or in Kansas. There, the Republican Party was not substantially challenged by any effort on the part of Democrats or Greenbackers. But in Iowa, in 1886, the Greenback Democratic Alliance has some substantial success. And the Farmers Alliance there, which was the social basis of a lot of these agrarian movements, is able to lobby on a nonpartisan basis. And the Republicans in Iowa respond by actually agreeing to regulate. They become, in effect, progressive Republicans. They agree to regulate railroads. They establish an elected railroad commission that regulates freight rates. And they have other approaches to deal with the massive amount of debt that farmers were staggering under, particularly during the downturns in the economy. These are years where there's massive depressions in the East in particular, but across the country, 1893, there's a huge collapse of the economy, unemployment rate over 20%. There's no unemployment insurance. There's no Social Security. There's no nothing in the way of safety net. And it's the populace who are calling for actually an infrastructure bill, oddly enough. That's Coxey's army. They call for a program of providing public employment to compensate for the collapse of private enterprise and the inability of corporations to keep people on their jobs. And there's no social safety net. So the populace are about a whole range of reforms that play out in different ways depending on where we're looking at. In Iowa, for example, in Illinois, there's a denser network of railroads. So there's some degree of competition. In Kansas and Nebraska and the Dakotas, there's fewer railroad alternatives. And so those that exist are basically in a position to monopolize and charge whatever they care to.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Quad Cities NPR. I'm your host, Robin Johnson. I'm talking today with Steve Babson, who's a retired labor educator at the Center for Labor Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. He's written a book called Forgotten Populists: When Farmers Turn Left to Save Democracy. We've been talking a little bit about the book and the use of he's describing more defining the term populist more in terms, I guess, the party, how it came about in the late 1800s. For our listeners, you know, who maybe aren't as, you know, haven't studied political parties over the years, there's been a tendency in the United States, people say, well, why haven't been there? There have been third parties. What usually happens is one of the two major parties absorbs the ideas of the people of these third parties. Is that kind of what happened with the populists and why they went away in the early 1900s?
Absolutely. I think what happens is that in our two-party system, in contrast to a parliamentary system, a minority party, representatives elected to parliament, can still participate in the choice of the executive, the prime minister, where you put together coalitions of many, often smaller parties, and they therefore have some impact on policy. In the United States, the executive is not chosen by a parliamentary majority. It's chosen directly at the ballot box. And so it's very hard to maintain a third party presence, but they erupt and they come along every once in a while, and they have an enormous impact on the existing two parties systems, where politicians can see that there's a need that is not being tapped by the existing two parties. And so the Democrats in particular, 1896, start to pick up on that. And that gets the ball rolling over time, with Woodrow Wilson, and then particularly with Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s, adopting a whole lot of the populist program. They don't do so by name, but what they're focusing on is the need for corporate regulation, for an expansion of the money supply, taking us off of the gold standard so that we can actually develop a money system that matches the needs of a growing economy, and a whole range of issues that support working people and farmers with a social safety net so that they can deal with the periodic downturns that characterize our capitalist economy. And so I think there's definitely a way in which third parties can actually implement a process of transforming the two existing parties. That's happened over time. But I think part of what that dynamic has been about historically has been changed by the use now of primary elections, where alternative voices within the two parties can actually develop a real presence and actually often enough change the direction of those parties from inside.
We'll still refer to other people in news articles now as populists. I've seen a lot of different people described as populists by reporters, including Donald Trump, former President Trump. Our former congressman here in the Illinois side of the Quad Cities, Lane Evans, a Democrat, described himself as a populist. What's your thought on people now kind of referring to themselves that way? Obviously, it's a different term based on the issues that led to the original formation of the Populist Party. But as far as a description of somebody, can somebody still be a populist type candidate now?
Well, you know, to me, as an historian, I place my bets on an understanding of who the populists were and what it represented in a transformation of America's political terrain. But some people use it, excuse me, as a term referencing the use of anti-elitist rhetoric. And that can be common to the left and the right, where in both cases, they're focusing on an elite that is compromising the needs of the broader population. Now, they're focusing on different elites. On the left, more often, they're focusing on the role of corporate elites and the mega-rich, whereas on the right, they're usually focusing on what they might call the media elite or the liberal elite, and they're arguing on often enough on behalf of some notion about resentments regarding to ethnic and racial matters, or immigration or what have you. And to my mind, what we're talking about is a different kind of resentment. And a lot of observers will say, well, in both cases, it's anti-elite. And in both cases, they're tapping into resentments. And I would say resentment can be very different. Some resentment is based on the actual consequences of being compromised in the marketplace and in your jobs by excessive corporate power. That's a different resentment from people who are feeling basically that their white skin privilege or that there's immigration is flooding local labor markets or whatnot. That's a different kind of resentment, and I find it much more dangerous and much less positive. I think what Trump is about is an anti-elitist rhetoric and not that cloaks his real intent. His real intent is to further enrich himself and the billionaire class that he represents. That's his real intent. That's what he did when he was in office. If you look at the consequences of his program, it's tax breaks for the rich, it's deregulation, it's empowering corporation at our expense. He talks an anti-elitist line, but it's basically a manipulation, I think, on behalf of what amounts to, I think, in his case, a kind of budding fascism.
Well, but he did even better in 2020 than he did in 2016. I do think there's an element of this, and you can trace it back. George Wallace was called a populist. He spoke against elites. And I think I do remember Trump coming into our region where he flipped a lot of counties that had previously gone for Barack Obama. He flipped them by coming in and talking about trade, for example, trade issues, and where people had lost their jobs around here due to trade agreements. So I feel like it's a little more nuanced than that. I do think that, you know, I see what your point is, but I think he also spoke to resentment of the elites insofar as saying trade is going to be good for you because we're going to retrain you for all these coding jobs or whatever. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And I would look back to the populace. My beef is with both parties. And I think the Democrats are to blame for their abandonment of many working class issues and particularly with respect to free trade. And I blame Bill Clinton for that. NAFTA was a disaster. And if you look at, and I've looked at some rural counties in Michigan that voted Obama and then their plants closed and moved to Mexico under NAFTA. And all of a sudden, there's a lot fewer union people. There's a lot more resentment. There's a lot more hardship. And people, they're looking for some kind of a way of venting their frustrations with that. And they're going to vote for someone who might actually direct that attention to the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has abandoned them in some respects. And I think it's important that Democrats think about how they need to reassert a working class perspective that focuses on the needs of the broadest possible population instead of basically following in the footsteps of Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates.
Got 2 minutes left here, Steve. I'll have you speculate a little bit just for fun, I guess. But are there people out there right now who come closest to the populist existed back in the 1800s? And I know it's not fair to a degree because the issues are a little different, but some of them are, I mean, to a degree. But who do you think comes closest to capturing the old populist line now?
Well, my personal favorite is Bernie Sanders. I think in a lot of ways, he would fit right into the populist movement of the 1890s, but obviously updated with an understanding of what that means today. Bernie Sanders would be my guy. And it's a shame that he's actually burdened with the same problem that both Trump and Biden have, which is his advancing age. But I would love to have seen Bernie Sanders do better in 2020 and 2016. He came close in a way that actually revitalized an understanding of how these issues could potentially be the basis for a future movement that addresses the needs of the broadest possible working class population.
Well, Steve, it's a great book for our listeners out there. If you want to learn more about the origins of the term populist, and again, it's very, very timely right now, and you could make your own judgments on the use of the term now. The book is called Forgotten Populists, When Farmers Turn Left to Save Democracy. It's written by Steve Babson, B-A-B-S-O-N, who's written 6 books now. He's a retired educator. He lives in Detroit. He worked at Wayne State University at the Center for Labor Studies. And so it's a very timely book, as I said in the introduction, and for people wanting to learn more about the use of the term populist, because you see it a lot. What is it? Where did it originate? This book will tell you. Steve, thank you so much for taking the time to be my guest today.
Thank you so much. And if people want to learn more, then go to ForgottenPopulist.com. There's also a video there they can take a look at.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.